double major at York University. And then I did a master's at York University in science and technology studies.
That's a really interesting career path. So to follow up that question, what made you interested in pursuing this specific area of science?
So, I mean, I've always been very inquisitive. I'm a little too inquisitive. I always wanted to understand the external world, and I always wanted to understand how we understand human beings, the external world. These questions would always float around in my head. Also, like, my dad is an avid reader of any subject under the sun, and we always had a lot of philosophy books and science physics books. So that definitely influenced me.
So our next question is, your research involves the history, philosophy, and sociology of physical sciences. Can you explain what that entails and how you conduct research in these areas?
Right. So how I conduct research is basically conceptual analysis, methodological analysis, analysis at the level of science, and analysis at the level of the analysis of science. So there's a bit of a meta there. So there's these three fields. There's history of science where, they look at the final product, the theories, and how theories change into other theories. You have the philosophy of science where they look at the foundations. They look at methodology, implications of science. And then you have sociology of science where they look at the individual scientist in the scientific community and how they're influenced also by the broader social context. And these three areas are, they provide really good insight into science, but they don't always integrate very well. There's a lot of disagreements. So what I'm doing is I'm developing a methodology, so a way of doing history of science, which includes the psychology of science. And I think from that perspective, we can kind of integrate them in a smoother way. So, and specifically, I focus on a disagreement between philosophical pluralism and sociological relativism. And I think that by incorporating the psychology of science, we can kind of integrate them in a way and in a smooth way, in a way that's really beneficial, that really broadens our understanding and deepens our understanding of science.
All those different areas, at first, when you hear them separately, they sound very different. So it's always intriguing to see how they would connect. But I think that's really interesting to see how you kind of separate them, but they also overall connect at the end.
I can.
So for our next question, I'm sure being in your position right now did not happen easily. You must have had to overcome a lot of challenges, especially with having a disability. Could you tell us about some of the challenges you faced along the way and how you overcame them?
Yeah, so I'm visually impaired. When I was 7, I lost my central vision due to a condition called Stargardt's disease. And a few years ago, I had a separate health incident where I actually had a brain tumor. Luckily, I'm fine. Everything's good now. But that exacerbated my disability as well. So, I mean, it's definitely not been an easy road. But I've managed, thanks to a really great support system, my friends, my family. But even more important than that, I had wonderful supervisors. So at the master's level, I had Professor Bernard Leitman as my supervisor. And right now I have Professor Yiftek Fahig as my supervisor. And they've just been incredible, and not just in understanding that I'm a student with disabilities, but in accepting and encouraging me as an ambitious student with disabilities. So they recognized my determination. They knew that I would work hard. They never gave me a sense that I couldn't do anything or that what I'm working on is too ambitious. They helped me. They gave me the space that I needed to kind of develop my ideas. If it wasn't for that, I mean, I wouldn't have been able to, for example, win an SSHRC award. I think it's called the Joseph Armin Bombardier Scholarship, which has funded me for 3 years. The support system, the supervisors have really helped me excel.
That's really inspiring. And I think it highlights how important it is to have a supportive community surrounding you. And connecting to that question, do you have any advice for students who have a disability and want to pursue research?
So generally, there's a lot of accessibility technologies. I mean, I'm still learning about accessibility technologies that I never knew are out there. So there's a lot of things that are out there to help people, no matter what your disability is. Also, at the university level, there are accessibility services. My experience at York and my experience at U of T have been phenomenal. They help you kind of manage your way, figure out accommodations, all of that. So definitely look into the accessibility services that are around.
Absolutely. I think that's really great advice. And for our next question, at the core of your research, you question objectivity. Can you elaborate on how the role of ambiguity can provide clarity in understanding how cognition and socializing play a role in the development of scientific knowledge?
Right. So there's a lot of elements in that, so I'll try to get it all in. Yeah. But the historiography that I'm working on is kind of based on a quote by Einstein, which says that scientific thinking is nothing more than a refinement of everyday thinking. And this is particularly relevant and interesting because Einstein and his special theory of relativity ushered in a whole new era in physics where we didn't know anymore what the link was between everyday thinking and scientific thinking. So, you know, for example, if you have a billiard ball and you'll have like one billiard ball rolling and then it hits a second billiard ball, so it moves from point A to point B, hits the second billiard ball, the second billiard ball moves from point B to point C. There's a trajectory, there's a causal relation. That's sort of how we understand objects in our everyday world, right? But objects in special relativity or quantum mechanics don't behave that way. And there's a lot of strangeness and we don't know how to connect it, how we observe everyday life. The role of ambiguity, the way that I'm trying to present it is, the way that we manage ambiguity in our everyday understanding is we can also recognize that we also use that in our scientific understanding. And also we can recognize shortcuts that scientists have made and that scientists have been really explicit about making. By kind of keeping in mind all of these things, we can kind of find a way back to this idea that scientific thinking is a refinement of everyday thinking.
That is a great breakdown of such a complex topic. And kind of building on that question, one of your areas of interest is looking at the philosophy of perception. What role do you think perception has in the development of science and specifically in the scientific community?
So going back to this idea that scientific thinking is a refinement of everyday thinking, even though there's been skepticism in the philosophy of science when it comes to perception, there's a view in the philosophy of perception that argues that, you know, we don't see the world as it is, right? What we see is a representation. So if you're painting a sunset, the painting is a representation of the sunset, but even the sunset that we see is a representation of something that we don't really know what it looks like. And so from that perspective, perception goes beyond what you immediately observe. It goes into memory, it goes into imagination. So if I were to tell you, imagine walking out of your front door and looking at your front yard, or imagine your childhood home from the rooftop. You could imagine these things, even if right now you're not looking out your front door, or you may never have been on your rooftop, on the rooftop of your childhood home. And so that kind of way that we're able to imagine and remember in everyday life is the same kind of thinking that we do in scientific building models or even thought experiments, where we think of scenarios and we draw conclusions from these scenarios, even though we may not have performed it. And it's proven to be a really, really valuable tool in science. That's the role of perception in science in my work.
And for our last question, what do you think the scientific community needs right now?
Recognizing the role of ambiguity. We're focused a lot on success in science, the successful theories. We're focused on the final product. What I try to bring in is, okay, let's look at how we built these theories from principles to models to theories, how we kind of built it up and how that evolved over time and how we overcame ambiguity along the way, and ways in which, as I mentioned before, we've made shortcuts because that's the best that we could do at a given time. So the role of ambiguity is definitely a big one.
That's great insight, and it even highlights the importance of social science in research and in the scientific community in general. So those are all our questions for today, and I would like to thank you for joining us today, Rula. Hearing about your experiences and career path and how you overcame so many obstacles was very inspiring.
Thank you so much.
Thank you again, and that's it for this week of SciSection. I'm your journalist, Janessa Furtado, and make sure to check our podcast available on global platforms for our latest interviews.
Welcome to SciSection. My name is Timur Bikaliyev, and I'm the journalist for the SciSection radio show broadcasted on CFMU 93.3 FM radio station. We are here today with Dr. Daniel Jones. He received his PhD in personality and social psychology in 2011 and is now an associate professor and researcher at the University of Nevada's School of Business. Dr. Jones researches dark personalities and emophilia. Thank you for coming on here, Dr. Jones.
Thank you for having me.
So what is emophilia?
So emophilia is an individual difference that predicts how fast, easily, and often somebody falls in love. Love is a very difficult thing to define. It's been subject of scrutiny of poets and scholars and philosophers for thousands of years. However you want to define that, high emophilia individuals describe those who have a hair trigger for falling in love. So they fall in love much faster and quicker than other types of individuals.
And why do you think emophiliacs seek out love or love more than the general population?
According to most of the research we've done, we've found that they have a high approach motivation to engage in relationships, and they have a rush of pleasure that comes along with falling in love. So for an individual who, let's say, goes out one night, meets somebody, there's a clock that starts from the time they meet the person until that relationship develops, until they decide, oh, all right, I'm in love. I think I'm in love. And for some people, in extreme cases, that can range from overnight to 10 years or more. So the reason why individuals who are emophilics fall in love so quickly and higher at normal rates is they have this rush, this lower threshold. And the way I kind of describe, I actually have a book coming out on emophilia at Oxford University Press called The Science of Serial Romance. We all know what sexual permissiveness is, or sociosexuality, as it's referred to in literature, unrestricted sociosexuality, somebody who has sex or willing to have sex very quickly upon meeting somebody. The original authors of that phenomenon describe that there's a bit of a threshold, right? Some people have kind of a lower minimum threshold to meet to say, okay, I'm ready to go to bed with this person versus a much higher threshold. I argue emophilia is the same thing, except with respect to the acknowledgement or the feeling that you are in love, right? Some people have a very, very low threshold and some people have a very high threshold. But the important point to emphasize is that it is a want and an approach process, which differentiates it from related constructs like anxious attachment, which is a need construct, right? And so anxious attached individuals say, I need you. I can't live without you. You are my world. And they cling to an individual for self-esteem, for self-worth, things like that. Emophilia, while it correlates slightly with anxious attachment, is not the same in the sense that emophilia is a want process. I want you. I'm excited. I can't get you off my mind. And it happens much earlier in a relationship.
So how would our listeners know if they're emophiliacs? And what percentage of the population are emophiliacs?
So emophilia is at present assessed using my EP scale, which you can find at darktriad.co under Take a Survey. However, I understand you'll also be providing a link. And if you take that survey, we will give you feedback on your emophilia score along with ranges and norms of the population for the population and where most people score. Emophilia in psychometric terms, the psychology of assessment, is pretty normally distributed, which means that you will find individuals just like extroversion or agreeableness, you have a nice normal curve where 10 to 15% of the population are pretty darn high. Most of the people are somewhere in the middle and a handful are very low. And so, you know, and it's important to understand that if you're high in emophilia, it's not a psychological disorder. It's not just like being super high in extroversion is not a psychological disorder. It can become pathological, can interfere with your life or lead you to make poor decisions in either direction. But it does not in and of itself constitute a pathology. It's an individual difference trait.
So Dr. Jones and me spoke about adding a link before we recorded this episode. It should be at the very top of the description for all the major podcast platforms. If you are on radio and the link isn't there, it might be worth checking us out on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or Google Podcasts. And the next question is, what are the typical highlights or like the best and happy moments and frustrations that hemophilics might experience?
That's a really good question. So the typical highlights is definitely the repeated rush of falling in love. Individuals high in hemophilia are kind of self-deceptive about how long this relationship is going to last, right? They don't go into the relationship saying, well, I know I'm probably going to be in love with this person for 3 weeks and it's going to end. So no, they really genuinely most of the time believe that this is the one now. And, you know, their friends will be typically I've heard stories and I've interviewed people who have said like, yeah, we've heard that before from you 3 times last year, you know, and that's how an hemophilic individual rolls, right? And so you have this process by which they rush into the love, and it's a powerful, it's a genuinely exciting experience for them. And so they have these high highs when they rush into the love. The frustrations and the struggles do come in because hemophilia doesn't turn off very often once you do find even a great partner. So they'll start to get a wandering eye over time because the attraction towards interlopers and outside members of the relationship will start to become attractive as well. And so that hemophilia, that rush of falling in love, they have to be very guarded about how close they get to people, because that hemophilic tendency will take over and then they're very prone. I have a paper right now with two of my excellent grad students who are studying infidelity among hemophilics, and they have a very high propensity for both sexual and emotional infidelity for that reason.
Have you ever had an experience with someone that you suspected that might have hemophilia? What's the story behind this new concept?
Yeah, that's a good question. So the story behind the concept was interesting. I was really enamored with research by David Buss and some evolutionary psychologists and on sexual and emotional infidelity. I think a lot of people got interested in that topic. It's both controversial and interesting. And so I wanted to look at past history. So I am a huge fan of Kevin Smith. I'm excited that Clerks 3 is coming out and all this. And so Chasing Amy, his movie, was really what got me thinking about infidelity but not so much infidelity as much as past history, sexual history. Spoiler alert for Chasing Amy, some past history struggles that go on in the relationship there. And so I wanted to look at these sexual versus emotional concepts in the past. So would you avoid a partner that's had sex with, you know, 23 people in the past year? Would you commit to them versus fell in love with 3 different people in the past year, right? Or 6 different people in the past year. And so I conducted a study like that, and I submitted it to Personality Social Psychology Bulletin. It's a great, great journal, and they rejected it. But the feedback was, that your actual study wasn't that interesting. But in the terms, I was talking about, you know, okay, so we have sexual permissiveness and emotional permissiveness as talking about the targets. And they said, we're really interested in this emotional permissiveness concept. We hope you develop that more. And so I went to my mentor at the time, Del Polis, and said, and I repeated the study. I said, can you help me with the study? He said, no, the reviewers were right. The study was terrible. But this emotional permissiveness thing is really interesting. I want you to go develop a scale and pursue it. And the rest is, as they say, history. But the term hemophilia actually wasn't coined by me. It was coined by my friend Dana Weiser at Texas Tech in family studies. We were struggling to publish because the initial term was emotional promiscuity. And understandably, a lot of people struggled with the term promiscuity carrying some negative connotations and baggage. So she helped me develop the term hemophilia. And have I had experience with somebody who is high in hemophilia? Yes, I have. Not research, it's me search. I've had times in my life when I've displayed hemophilia as well as, in my book, I have at least 5 to 7 really close friends that have displayed hemophilia. And it does help elucidate the construct when you're having these conversations with people and you're like, wow, you know, you do. And very often they'll acknowledge, yeah, no, I know I've said that before, but this is the real thing now, right? So that's been a really interesting thing. And so, you know, I mean, I'm happily married now and my wife and I laugh about it.
Where are you right now with your hemophilia research?
So right now, that's another great question. So right now, we're working towards finishing our infidelity paper. Should be submitted fairly soon. Because I've entered into a management program and a business program, I've pivoted slightly on the concept of hemophilia to develop what we call premature trust. And so we've taken the same basic concepts of, oh, okay, instead of love, like, you know, I think I love you after meeting you for 3 hours, it's, I think I trust you. So trust is a component of relationships and a component of these things, but we've applied it now to business settings. And we found that individuals who are high in premature trust tend to make poor decisions under certain contexts, right? So if you're asking a manipulative person to give an excuse, they're more likely to buy that excuse, right? As a premature, somebody who's high in premature trust. So we're applying it to that setting. We also have a ton of questions we're interested in, just getting it down to the mechanisms of hemophilia. So because of my appointment in a management school, hemophilia has become a side interest of mine. You know, one of the things that we really need to do that we've neglected is drilling down into the mechanisms, physiology, neuropsychology, and things like that. So anybody out there is listening to this that has access to a neuroscanner and knows how to use it, let's talk.
So I also saw that a lot of your past research is about three personality traits, including number one, narcissism, number two, Machiavellianism, and number three, psychopathy, which are together referred to as the dark triad. And how does your research in the dark triad traits interact with your research in hemophilia? Are there any interesting findings?
Yeah, so my friend and colleague Jacqueline Lechuga at UT El Paso and I published a paper showing that individuals high in hemophilia are actually drawn to these characters in relationships. And, you know, it's a very difficult thing because you know, these folks are prone to abusive behavior. They're prone to manipulation, lying, infidelity, exploitation. So you don't want to blame the victim or say that it's anybody's fault for getting in these relationships. And we're not. But what we are saying is that individuals high in hemophilia who feel this rush, because they rush in, they tend to ignore red flags. And so they tend to sidestep the warnings that would come with somebody who's a bit manipulative and a bit overconfident or arrogant or aggressive, right? And so they see the rush and they ignore the red flags along the path. And so they do find themselves ending up in relationship with these types of characters. And so that's one chapter in the book that I wrote was the allure of, you know, bad boys and bad girls for hemophilic individuals. And what's interesting along those lines is that narcissism in particular is through work of Del Paulus and Mitya Bach and other types of individuals. We know, and my friend Aaron Buckles, we know that individuals high in narcissism are just so charming in first encounters. They rule the roost when it comes to activities like speed dating or initial encounters. They're incredibly charming, and it's virtually impossible to disentangle overconfidence from confidence when you meet somebody, and especially in the first couple of encounters. So narcissistic individuals in particular can reel in somebody high in hemophilia with that charm. And while some of us who are lower and moderate in hemophilia won't fall in love right away, and then maybe the snow will melt enough for us to see, I'm not sure I want to be in a relationship with this person, where the hemophilic has already convinced themselves, it has already decided they're in love, and the wheels are turning. And so when you're in love, obviously you put some blinders on and you don't notice other things. So we believe that's the process of why they're drawn to dark personalities.
Is there anything that an hemophilic can do to prevent themselves from falling into these toxic relationships?
Absolutely. Listen to your friends, listen to your loved ones, the people who care about you. When they have concerns, they're not jealous necessarily de facto, they are concerned for you. One of the things that I encourage people to do is keep a journal or diary and track over time. You know, force yourself to take 30 days, 60 days before committing to any relationship of any kind. And, you know, give yourself longer periods of time that you just force your hand in the matter before, you know, any kind of major life decision like moving in or having a child or anything like that. Del Paulus demonstrated in 1998 that narcissistic charm wears off after about 3 months, right? So if you can force your attention towards those red flags and acknowledge them rather than dismiss them, listen to your loved ones and follow your journal, your guide, your diary, you can push towards this red flag. And the other thing is, you know, initially boring people on dates, that's maybe I'm guilty of that, get a bad rap, but people, as you get close to them, get more interesting over time very often. And so if somebody doesn't have that super exciting, let's go bungee jumping on our first date type of thing, and you got another person that's got red flags but is super exciting, I'd say, be patient with the boring person and worry about the red flag person. And if you're going to choose between the two, avoid the red flags altogether and give a boring person a second chance. And, you know, my former self would have been grateful for that. The other thing I'd say with avoiding toxic people is, you know, believe your eyes. You know, I think there's a great quote out there that says, when somebody shows you their true self, believe them the first time.
So a large part of our listeners are university students. What advice do you have for students to love in a healthy way?
I would say be patient with yourself. Make sure that you take your time in making major life decisions. You feel how you feel, and that's okay. Okay, you know, but take your time in making major life decisions, because there may be some people listening right now that are at the cusp of moving in or having a baby or getting married or engaged, and there are red flags. Maybe you have stepped over because the excitement, you find a way. Humans are remarkable creatures cognitively, and our ability to sidestep, reorganize, and cognitively rearrange facts in our brain to suit what we really want out of life and how we really want to see it gets the motivated mind can distort facts very easily. I'd say if you're thinking about making a major life decision and some of the things I've said today have resonated with you, talk to a counselor, talk to a therapist, talk to a trusted friend. I see a therapist. I think most people, if not all people, should be seeing a therapist at least once a year, twice a year for mental health checkups. Talk to somebody you trust and get an objective view. And I'm not negating the feelings. You feel how you feel. Anemophilics will always feel these rushes faster than non-anemophilics. There's nothing that ever is going to change. It's the decisions and the behaviors and the choices you make that are going to make or break the major things in your life. Like with my wife, you know, I mean, as an hemophilic, I am prone to having feelings for individuals. So I have to draw that line much faster than I think somebody who's low in hemophilia. So I get to know somebody, you know, and I'm constantly aware and mindful of my cognitive processes and, you know, actions and behaviors that could lead to a slippery slope. And I'm very actively cognitively and cognizant of those potential slippery slope. Do understand that, you know, you feel what you feel, and that's great, but do understand that nothing can destroy a life faster than major life decisions with the wrong partner.
So is there anywhere that students can look to find out more about you and your research? You mentioned that you have a book coming out.
Absolutely. So we have a book coming out, The Science of Serial Romance, by Oxford University Press. It's probably going to take, we're in the final revision stages now, so it might be another 6 months to a year, but individuals can always feel free to email me. My email is available at my website at darktriad.co, and the link will also take you to my website. You can find me at University of Nevada, Reno's management page, and you know, I'm happy to field any questions or emails that individuals have about this. So yeah, please, any questions, I'm happy to help.
Thank you. And for the final question, if you wanted someone to take away three key points from this episode, what would they be?
Well, the first one and the most important one is you feel what you feel, but it's your decisions that are going to ultimately impact your life. The second one would be that this is an individual difference trait. This is not something that is a pathology. Being low and being high yield trade-offs in and of themselves, right? So somebody who's too low in hemophilia may fall in love once or never. And if that love doesn't work out, then they may be alone. And, you know, and being alone is better than being with the wrong person, but that could be a very lonely place if they had been able to have a little lower of a threshold for these emotions. And being too high, obviously, can be a trade-off as well. And then the third thing I'd say is hemophilia is a very exciting line of research that is unique from other relationship constructs. And I'd really like to see more research out there on hemophilia, because it's a really uncharted waters. And it's a lot of exciting research that's yet to be done on the topic.
Thanks for taking the time to meet with me, Dr. Jones. That's it for this week of SciSection. I hope you learned something interesting about hemophilia. Make sure to check our podcast, available on global platforms, for our latest interviews.